with somebody at a Boston Red Sox game where we got talking about, you know, the challenges in the customer experience space. And this person mentioned to me that they'd heard about a company in Florida that was doing remote work. And they passed it off laughingly, like, you know, can you imagine how stupid that is? Nobody would work at home.
Welcome to the Milk Bottle Shopify e-commerce podcast, brought to you by Milk Bottle Labs, Ireland's top-rated Shopify experts. Milk Bottle Labs build, upgrade, migrate, and market Shopify and Shopify Plus stores all over the world. Milk Bottle will migrate you onto Shopify with zero interruption, guaranteed, or optimize your Shopify store and maximize store sales. This podcast is kindly supported by our favorite Shopify app and the only app we install in every store. Rewind.io is the leading backup solution for your Shopify store. We'll talk more about Rewind later. Now over to your host, founder of Milk Bottle Labs, Keith Matthews.
Hi folks, welcome back. My guest today is John Reardon, a Cork man from the south of Ireland, and John is the Director of Support for Shopify, with responsibility for hundreds of Shopify support gurus located all around the world in Lithuania, Ireland, Sweden, Canada, Japan and the Philippines. John has a wonderful background, which involves working for Virgin Atlantic Airways and the Apple Corporation. He's travelled extensively, but most of all, John is extremely passionate about working from home, where he actually moved support staff from Virgin Atlantic Airways to becoming completely 100% work from home. He's a proud dad. He's also a proud Cork man. And we cover such a range of topics here. It is definitely one of the most interesting conversations I've had on the podcast. So here goes. John Reardon, how are you?
I'm very well, Keith. Very well indeed. Thank you.
John, thanks for joining us. You are based in the south of Ireland in County Cork. Where in the south of Ireland are you?
I'm actually just outside Cork City in a suburb of Cork called Douglas. I grew up in Blackrock, which is literally the suburb next door. So kind of back home, I suppose, for want of a better description.
Is there a large cruise ship port, or was there at one point in Douglas in County Cork?
No, but Blackrock, anybody who would know the Blackrock area, it's where Páirc Cuíve is and the Marina Walk. There's a lot of, for example, rowing clubs on that stretch. And all the ships that came into Cork Harbour would have come right up through Blackrock and past Blackrock Castle and into the port of Cork. So it would have a very strong maritime history, even though they're now, the port of Cork is moving out to further out the port, and the city centrepiece will cease to be essentially a trading element of the city in the near future.
I should know the answer to this, John, but is it East Cork or West Cork?
Well, that's a very funny question to ask somebody from Cork, because East Cork to somebody from Cork is kind of anywhere east of Middleton, from Middleton sort of towards the Yall area and
right.
Gorgeous area of East Cork. And then West Cork is kind of, you know, from west of Bandon, and then the rest, then there's North Cork, which is kind of touching on Limerick. And then the rest we just call Cork. There's no middle Cork.
So you're in neutral.
It's just Cork. Thank you.
Very good. Very good.
Set chip on both shoulders.
Yeah, I knew when you ask most Cork people that they kind of touches a nerve. It's like east and west of the States, isn't it? Or North Dublin and South Dublin, yeah.
Okay. It's just Cork, John, by.
It's Cork by, yeah, it's just Cork. We had a meetup down there a couple of years ago, and actually it was a great success. I love going down there. There's a great train service, would you believe, as I'm sure you know, from Dublin to Cork. And any time we go down there to meet clients, we manage to get more work done on the train than we do in the office. But of course, that has all changed with the current situation, and we'll get to that in a few minutes. John, the last time we met, I think it was maybe over 2 years ago, or it could have been three, and it was a dinner in the west of Ireland in Limerick. And I remember specifically talking to you because you had just started with Shopify. When was that?
That is, you're almost right. It was actually 2 weeks before I joined Shopify. I attended the same it was a Shopify internal summit. Like I said, 2 weeks before I joined, I think it was something around the 12th, 13th, 14th of May in 2017. So I went and attended as an observer, and you were actually on the panel, if I recall correctly. You were on one of expert panels, and we ended up having dinner together with the wider group. Yeah, so that was a very interesting experience for me to see what the company was like 2 weeks before I joined.
It was a great event and a good opportunity for kind of an insight. I walked away from that evening, John, and you know, the next day I remember talking to Peter about you. I had a really, really interesting conversation with you, and I remember you explaining your history and your career prior to Shopify. And I was fascinated by, you had mentioned a number of brands over a pint that night. One of them was Virgin Atlantic, another was US Airways, and another was Apple. So just give us an insight into your career, which is wonderfully varied and has brought you around the world as well.
There's a couple of really interesting kind of aspects to it and kind of tying it into where we are right now. Each of my kind of career changes has had some correlation to the significant and economic events of the time. So I came out of college in the late 80s. Ireland was a really tough place to get work. I remember coming out after my master's degree, I came out in a class where about 25% of people were unemployed 6 months after the master's program. It's the kind of numbers you wouldn't even hear, wouldn't even contemplate right now. So it was a much tougher time. And then there was one of these visa programs in the US. So it was early kind of, I think it was 1992, the second of the major visa programs. And I applied for a visa because I just thought Ireland was a bit of a basket case at the time, which it actually really was not the greatest place to be. It was kind of like almost a rusty backwater with economic philosophies that were in the dark ages. And in fact, if you go back and have a look from a historical perspective, the first uptick and the first roar of the Celtic Tiger, or basically the kind of the turning point, the inflection point, was actually November 1992. I happened to leave in October 1992. So maybe when the country offloaded me, it actually was probably a good thing for the economy. But I headed off to the US. And it was a fabulous opportunity for me because it took the Irish education system and married that to the level of opportunity in America. And it was just amazing. I was like a kid in a candy store. There were so many opportunities in the US. And I was lucky enough within a very short period of time to get a job with US Airways. And I had no major inkling or hankering to get into the travel business. But once you get into it, it just gets into your blood incredibly quickly. So I had a fantastic six or seven years at US Airways. And I ended up making some progress through the marketing organization there and ended up running the frequent flyer program. And it was probably, I think it was about a 45 million person frequent flyer program. It's one of the probably fifth or sixth biggest frequency program in the US at the time. So that was an incredible way to cut my teeth, to go from essentially being virtually unemployed in Ireland and 6 years later running one of the bigger loyalty programs in the US. It was a sharp change. And then the dot-com bubble happened around the late 1990s, and I got approached by a company that was selling cars on the internet. It was the first of the kind of, I suppose, crazy aspect of the dot-com boom. Was a company called Autobytel. And I left US Airways to set up a frequency program for a car buying service. And yeah, I did actually say that, a frequency program for a car buying service, which in hindsight was probably the dumbest career move I ever made, because there is almost no frequency in car buying. It's a once every 2, 3, 4 years at best for most people.
What was how was the program envisaged, or how was it planned?
Keith, I still ask myself that question 1 year later. All I know is that I took my wife of 1 year and we uprooted and we moved to just south of LA, to Orange County. And we moved there following this dream. I'll be very honest with you. They were throwing a ton of stock options and they threw a ton of money at me. And I thought this was what one did when you follow the American dream. I was there for 4 weeks and I got a phone call. In that 4 weeks, I literally was looking at the portfolio and what I was trying to accomplish and what I was trying to do. And I realized, oh dear Lord, what have I done? But 4 weeks later, I got a phone call from Virgin Atlantic, who I had been talking to on and off for a couple of years. And Virgin Atlantic, I had gone right up the aisle with Virgin Atlantic about a year beforehand for a role. And then the person who was going to leave didn't leave. And then I got a phone call 4 weeks into my trip to California from Virgin Atlantic to say that that role was now available again. Would I be willing to take it? No interview, like it was being offered to me straight up. So I actually left Autobytel after 4 weeks, which was another very tough decision to make.
Yeah, again. So you had to, did you have to move with your wife again?
Yeah, I mean, but it raised a very interesting point that's kind of stuck with me for the rest of my career. So from an ethical perspective, when a company has invested time, effort, and energy into you to bring you on board, from an ethical perspective, are you doing the right thing if you just bail out that quickly? So I spent a good few days really tossing the idea and the thoughts over and back as to what I would do with it. And there were a couple of things which I'm not going to necessarily get into, but you know, they had paid me a sign-on fee that weighed heavily in my mind as to how to deal with that. So I made a decision that I'm kind of happy enough with and proud of still regarding that as to how I handled that. In essence, we had not unpacked our boxes from our trip from the east coast of the US to the west. And we just basically put the boxes back in a truck and moved back east. And I ended up with Virgin Atlantic from 1999 to right through 9/11, which was a cataclysmic event for the airline industry. And then I got involved, I left the marketing arena, and I ended up running the customer service function at Virgin. And I had a fortuitous meeting with somebody at a Boston Red Sox game where we got talking about, you know, the challenges in the customer experience space. And this person mentioned to me that they'd heard about a company in Florida that was doing remote work. And they passed it off laughingly, like, you know, can you imagine how stupid that is? Nobody would work at home.
Yeah, people, but that was just that was early days, John, wasn't it?
That was exactly, yeah. And, you know, how would this work? It would never work, and all this crazy stuff. And I remember actually agreeing with the person. And I remember the woman's name, and I don't know what company she worked for. And I nodded in agreement. Yeah, that's a crazy idea. And I was driving back from Boston back to Connecticut where I lived that night. And I had a moment of thought going, hang on a second, there's something to this. So the next day or two, I started looking stuff up online, and I went and approached the company that she had mentioned, and I got them to come in and talk to me. And I spent about a month or two trying to find where the catch was. And I eventually said to the sales guy, like, just do me a favor, before I sign up, tell me what the catch is. And 18 years later, I'm still waiting for the catch as to what I did wrong. So I was quite smitten by the whole remote exercise. And over the course of the next year, we moved 100% of the Virgin Atlantic customer experience team to remote. And I've never looked back since.
So, John, you've got serious amount of knowledge and depth of the airline industry. In light of what's going on now, I'm assuming your eyes and ears are pointed in that direction as well. Because, I mean, is the crisis at the moment the largest that the airline industry would have had ever? Or is that an exaggeration?
Oh, just to put it in perspective, when on the 13th of September 2001, the executives of almost every airline in the U.S. made this credible decision, at the time it was deemed incredible, to ground 20% of the fleet and lay off 20% of the staff. What's happening now is that airlines are grounding 95% of their fleet, and they're furloughing, temporarily laying off 80 to 90% of their staff. So it's 4x the severity of what it was. 4x. It's absolutely incredible. I mean, one of the biggest challenges that airlines are facing is where to put the aircraft. And as one wag in one of the aviation geek websites that I'm involved in, as one wag made a comment, like, there's copious space to park the airplanes. It's called runways because they're not being used.
Yeah. I saw a screenshot last night of British Airways. I'm assuming that it was Heathrow. And I can only imagine the value of the fleet that is parked up. And, you know, can you imagine the cost of having to go back into those airplanes and then recommission them? I'm assuming they'll all have to be reserviced as well. It's phenomenal. I don't even know how anybody could even measure it. Obviously, people within the aircraft industry would know.
But Keith, like, again, there's another aspect that you're entirely correct. To recommission, to basically decommission an aircraft and then recommission an aircraft is a significant engineering feat and cost. There's another aspect of it as well, is that to keep a flight crew current and trained and current, in other words, licensed to fly, you must have a certain number of rotations or flights. Once a fleet is grounded, or a variety of aircraft are grounded, you're going to have some people who are going to lose their status, their ability to fly, because they have not been able to get on board and actually fly an aircraft. So airlines are going to have to retrain people in all of the various in all of their various classifications. So you can't just ground a fleet and then flick a switch and have everybody up and running again. It just doesn't happen that way.
You're saying that experienced pilots will actually have to go through rigorous retraining?
Oh, yeah, yeah. If their license isn't current, and like I don't know the regulations at all, but to maintain your status as being to be able to fly, you have to be flying on a relatively regular basis. And a lot of people, the airlines are going to have a challenge to keep enough people current so that when they want to just ramp up an airline again, and it's a huge challenge. I still have a lot of friends in the airline business, and this is, like I said, this is multiple times more challenging than post 9/11. Post 9/11, the only issue that faced the traveling consumer was, am I afraid that someone's going to put a bomb on the plane? Now, everybody is likely to look at every other passenger on board an airplane and go, is this person going to be too close to me? Are they sick? Are they what? You're going to look at everybody as a potential problem or an issue. And I'll just be very vulnerable and very personal on this one. I fly quite a bit, obviously working for a Canadian company, and I love flying. My appetite towards future business travel has significantly diminished. I am not relishing the first, I suppose, mandatory trip for me to travel to Canada for a meeting. It will come.
It's interesting that you say that, because obviously, you know, if you're a large organization, commercial real estate, you know, and the demand for it is clearly going to go down after this, because of, you know, the reason we're going to talk later is obviously to talk about the working from home. The other large industry that will be hit is corporations will clearly take employee safety into account and reduce the budgets for international travel. Now, I'm assuming that the airlines are already trying to work that out, but there's a major hit there, you know, that will naturally occur, which would then, would I be right in saying then that air travel could never, like even taking a recession into it, air travel could never really return ever to the highs of the current times, because specifically that corporate travel will reduce. Is that right?
Yeah, I'll make a wild statement here. I don't know if we will see a return to the flying levels that we have now within the next 10 years. And I think the likelihood that we will, within the next 10 years, get back to, you know, 29 euros one way to Spain type flights, like that's so far out in the horizon, I just can't contemplate it right now. Let's look at another aspect of this as well, is hotel room nights. I don't know the exact number, but I saw an article in the newspaper in the last month or two regarding the number of room nights in Dublin that are taken every day. This was pre-COVID. That were taken every day by multinational companies in the Dublin area. And that was fueling the incredible growth in hotels. And as of February, I think there were 44 hotels under development in the Dublin area. That requires a lot of people to travel. It requires basically a lot of companies wanting their people to travel. And to the point you just raised, a lot of employees being willing to travel. I think those two markets have had the stools kicked from underneath them. And you're going to find a lot of people, I think a lot of companies who are relying on that aspect of business, the general business travel, they're going to have some serious questions that need to be asked as to what will the return to normal be. Now, there's another aspect to that, which is people who have money in their pockets who can make a big and bold bet will probably do incredibly well. And every crisis spawns people who are opportunistic, who are cash rich, who are able to spot an opportunity and make the right play. But I think, you know, for the incrementalists out there, I think it's going to be a real challenge for people who are going to look for small incremental changes. It's going to be really tough, because this is not a small incremental change. This is a cataclysmic, life-changing event that none of us will ever experience in our lives again.
Yeah, good point. And for some reason, I don't know why, but I kind of have a weak spot for the airline industry. I always find myself, you know, reading about the manufacturers and the airlines. That's one thing I never thought of, actually, with the actual price of flying. there has to be a demand and supply effect for the price to be more than likely pushed up. But look, who knows what will happen. But look, thanks for sharing your experience on that. Personally, it's an industry which I'm absolutely fascinated with. Now, John, you returned to Ireland around, I think it was 2006, 2007, and Apple have a very large base in the south of Ireland. How did you end up working for Apple?
So around 2006, after we'd done the whole outsourcing of the Virgin call center and brought in a remote element to it, Apple came knocking on the door looking for somebody to help them structure a remote workforce, and ended up on my doorstep. So I got a call and I was asked to, if I was interested in taking essentially a contract gig with Apple. So I ended up working for a year with Apple, and it was the year leading up to the launch of the iPhone. So it was from about April 2006 to around, I think, July 2007 approximately. And in that time period, Apple had yet to announce the iPhone was coming, but obviously the company knew it was coming, and they needed to build an enormous repository of contact center talent and availability and the ability to ramp up quickly. So they viewed the remote space as the way to do it because it didn't have the bricks and mortar element to it. So they knocked on the door of the company that we were using at Virgin Atlantic, and that company said, oh, you should talk to this guy. He's just done it for Virgin Atlantic, because we would have been kind of the marquee brand. So Apple came to me, asked me to come on board. So I ended up helping shape Apple's first foray into remote work. In fact, the very first phone call that Apple ever took across any of their platforms, be it AppleCare or the Apple Online Store, the first ever remote call was the 22nd of May, 2006, I believe, was the very first phone call, and which is about
John,
a year.
That sounds very late in the greater scheme of things.
It was actually quite late. I mean, if you think of it, with Disney was doing it in 1999. Apple's 2006. Yeah.
Wow. Interesting.
But it was a full year before the iPhone came, and the iPhone was the game changer.
Would you believe I was working in telecoms at the time? I was working for O2, and they were the first network to get the iPhone. And one of my claim to fames is the fact that I was one of the first 25 people in Ireland to have an iPhone. So I don't expect any rewards for that. But it was the 2G version. It was the kind of end-of-life version that they were trying to get rid of in the States. And I kid you not, the other 24 people that had them in the office, we all had to walk around the office with a plug and a charger in our back pocket, because the battery was that bad. It was just interesting. It was everywhere you went with that phone, everybody would say, can you give me a look at it? Can you give me a look at it? It was an interesting experience. In terms of Apple and in terms of Cork, John, have they a big presence now? Was it a great experience? Or is Apple very much rooted in Cork, or is that just an impression I have?
So I did a year with Apple on a contract basis, and then I managed the Apple business for a vendor of Apple's for a couple of years. And then Apple was looking to bring a senior leader into the Cork operation to run the contact center operation for Europe. And that was in 2010. So they approached me, and I'd been living in the States at this stage nearly 20 years. So again, my long-suffering wife, who I had dragged across the U.S. from east to west, was now being asked to move from, we were living on the beach in Florida, and I was asking her to move to Ireland in February in 2010. So fortunately, she said yes, but we moved back in 2010 for me to take this up, the role of director of the contact center operations for the Apple Online Store, which was a great, great opportunity. It was a wonderful experience. Yeah. At the time, I think Apple had about, in the time that I was there, in the 7 years I was there, we were as low as probably 400 people, and about as high as maybe we probably crested about 2,000 people at one stage. And that includes all of our vendor operations. And we had vendor operations in Belfast, Berlin, Barcelona, and Athens.
And all of the, in terms of the work from home conversation, I'm assuming that all of Apple staff were in a call center.
All of Apple staff was in a call center, yeah. There were some people in the US that were working from home. It wasn't until about 2014, I think, or around about 2014 that Apple first, to the best of my knowledge, dipped their their toe in the water, maybe 2013, with some small number of teams working from home with an at-home program. And even to this day, it would still be a smaller element of the greater scheme of things. I don't know the numbers now. I'm gone 3 years, but I'm guessing there's about 6,000 people in the operation in Ireland, and there's probably about 11, 12, 1300 would be working remote. So it's, you know, it's 20% at most, I think, of the staff.
John, you were there for 7 years. That's a decent chunk of a varied career. Do you miss the Apple way? Was there anything there that you, in particular, that did well? Or
the one thing that I missed at Apple is that when you work for a company with such a really incredible culture like Apple, is it's almost like you cross the moat and the drawbridge gets pulled up, and you're completely and utterly wrapped up in the culture. So in the time that I was there, I could count, I wouldn't say on one hand, but the number of times that I was dealing with people from outside of Apple was so, so few and far between that you lose. I'll just give you an example. The very first time that I'd ever heard of Slack, I'd never even heard the name Slack. It was after I joined Shopify, and when I was, the night that I met you, somebody said to me, "Oh, I'll ping you on Slack." And I'm like, "What are they talking about? What is a ping and what is Slack?" and I was working for, you know, what would ostensibly at the time have been the, you know, one of the most powerful technology companies in the world, but I had never heard Slack. And then the whole concept of Slack, I was like, "What is it?" Somebody had to sit down and explain it to me.
Let's take a short break, and I'll share the one app we install on every Shopify build. The team at Rewind.io have developed the leading backup solution for Shopify. Did you know there is no way of recovering lost data from a Shopify store? Rewind.io automatically backs up your store data. In the event of a data loss, usually due to human error, Rewind enables you to rewind your store back to its previous state. It's so simple and is used by some of the world's leading Shopify agencies, such as Kurt Elster of EtherCycle and Kelly Vaughan at The Tap Room. If your store is gaining traction, you may have multiple users making changes. Often store owners allow team or app developers enter a store to add code. Sometimes mistakes happen and data gets deleted. You can reduce your business risk today and prevent a costly catastrophe by installing the Rewind.io app on your Shopify store. Get your first month of Rewind for free by simply responding to any of the welcome messages or emails you receive after you begin your 7-day trial and mention this podcast. Now, back to the interview.
I'd say, John, you've got used to it by now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. God. So really, I suppose what you're saying is, you know, on the inside, they ran their business a certain way, and then that was it. They had their own ways of doing things, and it was, well, I suppose it's been written about in the past, the Apple way.
True. But I think, you know, one of the things, Keith, that the current situation causes challenges and changes for all of us. So I'm just going to give you one sort of story regarding how app, and the Apple wouldn't be alone on this one, but 20 years ago, if you were running a contact center, the type of person who was the frontline, your frontline customer service person, would be sitting at a desk, a row of desks, a bank of desks, and they would be sitting with a desktop computer, probably with a box under the desk and a monitor on the desk, right? And it was your classic desktop, because desktops, you'll remember at the time, laptops were expensive. Desktops were the cheap element.
I remember, yeah.
Okay. Now, over the course of time, the difference in price between laptop and desktop became narrower, but there still was a difference. But very few contact centers changed the way in which they provisioned their staff. So most staff in most contact centers around the world have maintained having a desktop rather than a laptop. Then COVID-19 happened around the world, and suddenly country after country, city after city, people were told they needed to take the equipment and go home. Now, for those people who were able to pick up a laptop and go, it becomes a very easy exercise. For those people who had to unbundle a desktop and a monitor and whatever, and put that under their arm and bring it home. First of all, there's a physical challenge to that. There's a security issue to it because you're not used to having all the IP protocols and all that kind of stuff. There is a ton of issues that were raised, and it's because industry had not made that morphing from to have a portable and movable workforce. It was an immovable workforce that was assumed to always be in one location. So I think the nature of business has changed so radically in the course of the last 2 months that when we go back to whatever the new normal is, I would venture to say that most companies, no matter whether they're frontline customer support or every other aspect, I think the day of a desktop may well be behind us, a long way behind us.
That's a very valid point, John. It's amazing sometimes, you know, I've worked in offices where everybody had a desktop and a laptop, and the laptop used to be the secondary device. In the old days of telecoms, just to go back to, you were talking there about the Apple and the release of the iPhone. In those days, when I worked in O2, O2 was basically the first mobile-centric company that I ever worked for, and we all had a BlackBerry. Most of us had a personal BlackBerry, and we had a personal BlackBerry, and then we had a business BlackBerry, and we had a laptop. So are you saying then, or is it correct to say then that really what COVID-19 has resulted in is an uplift in the acquisition and the sales of laptops, and possibly the death of the desktop?
Yeah, I think, you know, you go back to, Steve Jobs was the one who said in probably 2011, 2012, even sooner, that we're in a post-PC world. Right, and we're in a mobile world, but like the best manifestation of a proper mobile office is the laptop. Like most of us can do quite a lot of what we need to do on a mobile phone rather than a laptop, but the laptop is still the best, let's call it, portable office that we have. A desktop isn't, because it's just by nature it's not a portable device. And I think what this is going to change, it's going to be a significant mindset change for companies who routinely have not purchased the higher end laptops for lower end employees. That will change because the benefits are now so enormous and the risks of not doing it are also so enormous that, you know, we're going to have to be prudent, we're going to have to be smart, and we're going to have to give all staff the ability to be able to be very flexible. To not do that, it will be massively detrimental to a business.
Yeah, I interviewed Shauna Moran recently, and I know you know Shauna well. She's formerly a Shopify employee, and one of the things that she mentioned was that it's all very well giving people the tools, which is what you're referring to, but sending a staff member home to work and giving them a laptop and just giving them Slack and a couple of other tools isn't necessarily the answer either. So you've raised a very interesting point. There's a shift in terms of hardware. And there's also a shift in terms of psychology and in terms of the tools and software that they would be using. You know, if we segue then into Shopify, into your current role, in your experience, Shopify have a remote team in Ireland, okay? So even though you guys were very, very experienced in the remote area, have you still had some learnings, quick learnings in the last 6 weeks that frankly shocked you? Or were you guys already well tooled up for the current crisis?
We were very well tooled up. I mean, we had this wonderful, we were incredibly fortunate. And you know, this is where we've got to be very sensitive as well. We are in an industry, e-commerce, and providing an e-commerce platform that's actually still a highly desirous product. And there are people who are using our platform to advance their businesses and pivot their businesses. So we're one of the fortunate industries that still has significant demand. And we're also in a situation where our workplace hasn't changed because we were all working from home. So we have to realize the double lottery ticket that we got. And we do recognize that. But there's also some quirky and interesting things, and I don't want to belittle the severity of it, but for those of us who have set up home offices and are used to working in our home offices, the influx of other humans into our space in our own houses is a challenge. Like I'm now dealing with my wife using Zoom with her choir, my daughter using Zoom to an economics class, and my son doing a computer science exam in college on Zoom all at the same time while I'm having a conference call on Zoom or Google Hangouts. So, you know, we're all competing for that. There's more people in the house. So we have issues like that is one aspect. Another aspect of it, as an organization, Shopify would have about 40% prior to this, about 40% of the company were resolutely remote and 60% of the company around the world were office-based. You suddenly had this 60% of folks coming into the remote world and suddenly they were experiencing things that we had seen and watched and experienced ourselves over the previous couple of years. So to watch other people seeing it for the first time and experiencing it for the first time was actually a cathartic experience. It was wonderful. It's like watching tourists being enamored by wonderful sights. Yeah. It really was, because like they were discovering things and you're actually getting joy watching them discover things. Like, oh my God, you can really do that on a Zoom call? Yeah. Oh my God, you can really, really keep connection? Like things like drinks together on Zoom, right? All of the things that were so second nature to us. And I think what it says for those people who've been remote for a period of time, it's a real thumbs up to go, yeah, you know what? It's all good. It's all good. Now, there's an enormous onus, and something you and I have talked about in the past as well. For those of us who are relatively well experienced in the remote world, there's a tremendous societal onus on us to share those learnings with everybody else. Because, you know, from the Irish society perspective, the more and more that we make people comfortable with remote work, the better off the economy is going to be. And like, we were fortunate enough to be approached by some government departments asking for their help, because they know that our platform can help, but they also know that our experience in remote work is also very helpful. So we've worked with, obviously confidentially, but we've worked with a number of entities within the whole government structure to provide information on how to be successful in remote.
It's funny you say that, John, because I was just about to say there, weren't you lucky that the 60% that weren't working from home had the support and were able to ping the 40%, you know, to get direction and very quickly. I mean, I'm very surprised at people, how quickly people adapted. You guys have then taken it to another level in terms of advising other people external to Shopify, which is, I think it's admirable. I mean, we're both sharing learnings, you know, online as much as we possibly can. I've been sharing the tools that we use, for example, time trackers, Slack, Basecamp we use for our project management tool. In terms of your role in Shopify and in terms of Shopify in Ireland, you know, can you just give the listeners an example, just give them an indication of the scale of the operation in Ireland and what that operation does for Shopify and the overall platform worldwide?
Sure. And I'll just go one quick step back into history. So Shopify planted a flag in Ireland in the summer of 2015, started off with 50 people, 50 frontline customer support folks. And it was basically five teams of 10 with a leader in each team. And one or two people on the from an who are kind of, let's call it tier two escalated support folks. And that was the starting point. And over the course of the next 5 years, we have exploded in size. And we are vastly more than the 50 people that we started with. Won't be able to share the number with you, but it's multiples of that.
I'm assuming it's hundreds.
It's yes, significant yeah. hundreds. Yeah. Like by the time you and I met in 2017, we were at 150. Draw the line between the two, and you'll recognize that we're well more than double that 150 from a couple of years ago. Well more than that,
John. I've said this a few times to various people, and even on this podcast. There is one thing that amazes me about Shopify. Isn't it just wonderful that this e-commerce platform, as good as it is, can employ people in the west of Ireland, working in their houses and working in their apartments. Like, I found it wonderful before this current crisis. I mean, it's just like they started in the west of Ireland. You know, every time I go on to support and I ask a guru where they're from, the chances are they could be anywhere. Well, anywhere now, because they're all over, the staff are all over the country. But I used to love when someone would tell me, oh, I'm in Bundoran, I'm in Galway, I'm in East Cork, you know, just phenomenal. But anyway, continue. Give us an idea of the
structure. That's such a great point, because in 2017, we were almost exclusively in the Connacht, the greater Connacht area, basically from Donegal to Clare was where we were we tended to be, because we required at the very start for people to be close to Galway. So in other words, if there was a challenge or an issue from a technology perspective, we wanted people to have an area that we are to essentially be close to each other. But it ended up being so successful that we ripped off the Band-Aid and said, okay, doesn't matter, anywhere now. So we suddenly went from being in 7 counties in Ireland to being in 26 counties. And where this is enormously important from a regional development perspective is that, you know, we have probably 50% of the population in the country between the Greater Dublin and Greater Cork area. And in Shopify, we have about 10% of our employees in the Greater Cork, Greater Dublin area. We are completely counter-cyclical. And that's because of the fact that you've isolated. We essentially grew up on the West Coast. So still 50% of our staff would be in that Donegal to Clare corridor. Let's call it the northern half of the Wild Atlantic Way. 50% of our, or at least 50% of our people are there. So we do lean very much towards rural. And what that does to every community is incredible. So like one extra person in Kinvara could be the difference between the post office staying open, the bank branch staying open, an extra teacher in the school. It could be the difference between the local GA team being able to field a team in the intermediate championship or not. You know, and these small things make a difference. And, you know, the ones that become twos, that become fours, and then suddenly you have these communities building up and you have these remote communities of remote workers. I'm heavily involved in an organization called Grow Remote as well. And what Grow Remote has done, incredible job at stitching together all of those disparate groups of people who thought they were kind of probably on their own in these in small towns around, but suddenly discovered that, hang on, I'm not the only remote in the village. There's tons more people like that. And stitching those communities together, I think, has emboldened people to realize this is actually a massive opportunity societally and from governmentally. There's an enormous opportunity for us. And we have an opportunity now because the world has been turned upside down. How are we going to respond to this? You know, you've got hundreds of thousands of people. Okay, let me go back to the census, for example. The 2016 census indicated that there are just under 100,000 people commuting every day to Dublin from Kildare, Meath, and Wicklow. All right? 100,000 people a day. What's the likelihood at the end of this that that number will be the same? I think a lot of people are going to go, hold on a second, I don't have to endure this any longer. I've proven that I can do my job. And we can argue whether it's going to be 5% or 50%, right? It could be anywhere along that continuum. But I think we all agree it's going to be a significant chunk of people who will have proven to their employers they don't need to do that long commute anymore. So what's that going to do? It's going to shift the axis away from the cities, and it's going to embolden us more and more and more to allow people to work remote with potentially the ability to dip into an office on a consistent basis, but not be routinely based in an office. That is the incredible change that sits in the medium term for all of us.
You're absolutely on the money there. I live in Dublin. I'm originally from Kildare. So I was one of those individuals, you know, as you mentioned, doing the commute into Dublin. And straight away on a Friday, you notice that the traffic is less because obviously employers are, there's a lot of people that do one day a week or, you know, or 2 days a week. And that's obviously going to rise. But just one point, my brother made a point to me yesterday about expenditure, that a lot of people, because they're unfortunately in lockdown at the moment, aren't spending as much money. And what I think is going to happen is exactly what you just said. I've no idea of what the numbers are going to be. Are 20% of people going to be working from home after this, or 30 or 40? It obviously is, depends on the vertical that they're working in, depends on the industry. Wouldn't it be just fantastic if 20 or 30% of people did start working from home, and instead of driving to the cities in Ireland or driving to the cities in Canada or driving to whatever city that you're in the UK or America, and instead of buying a sandwich in the city, wouldn't it be fantastic if people bought their coffee and bought their sandwich in their local town? I mean, this actually has the potential to completely rejuvenate rural Ireland and rural UK potentially, and other parts of the states or the rest of the world where local economies have just been sucked dry as a result of the you know, the migration towards cities. Now, Just on that, is there anybody, are you guys in Grow Remote, are you guys measuring that impact, or is it even possible to measure? Is there a number for the value of 10 or 20 remote workers in a local economy, or does that even exist yet?
There are a variety of different metrics. I'll give you a few of them. So there's no one golden metric here, but there's a few things. We'll talk first of all in terms of in cost, right? There's a ton of studies out there that talk about the cost of actually, let's call it, housing an employee in an office. And the typical savings to a company to move somebody out of an office space and to have them working from home. And this is, there's been a number of such studies done around the world, but you'll see it runs the gamut from about $15,000 to about $22,000, $23,000. So let's take the midpoint there. Let's call it $18,000 a year in savings. That is quite significant, to put it mildly. There's also the issue of the time saving for people doing the commute. The average commute in Ireland is 27 minutes. From the last census, I think it was 27 minutes. Now, it grew quite a bit. It grew from, I think, 24 to 27. I'm directionally correct. I can't remember the exact numbers. But it was the rate of growth that concerned me, right? Not the actual, the ordinal number. And the reason why the ordinal number is not that worrying is that the generally accepted figure for an acceptable commute around the world is 42 minutes. If your commute is more than 42 minutes, that's the tipping point where you make significant decisions regarding housing and other stuff like that. So we're still well under that threshold. So it's still tolerable. But I think as a society, if we continue to allow that to creep up towards the 42 and creep up towards that tipping point, it's like, to be honest, it's like taking a rowing boat out at the top of the Niagara Falls and saying, ah, sure, I'm not going to go out over the edge. Nah, sure, it'll be fine. And we have to be very careful about that and very deliberate. And I think this is the moment for us to sit and think and go, hang on, what's the deliberate thing to do? So from a governmental perspective, the more and more we encourage companies and give them proper incentives and proper encouragement to have less people in the cities, what's actually going to happen is going to be a twofold thing. It's going to see a significant increase in the population, not just bedroom communities, but physically living in areas around the cities. And actually, to your point, spending money in those communities, not just commuting out and back every day. At the same time, it's going to free up a ton of space in our cities. And one of the things that was challenging for the IDA and a variety of other people over the course of the last couple of years were all these companies still looking to come into Ireland who still want to move into the cities and have the space in the cities, but there wasn't enough space. So we could technically, and it's possible, we could shift some of that focus out of the cities, free up some space, and potentially supercharge the economy. That opportunity exists for us, and we must make brave decisions if we're going to embrace it.
Yeah, and what you've described there can be done all over the world. It's not just an Irish issue. It's an issue, you know, obviously across the water. For, you know, the UK has a traffic problem around the country the same as everybody else, and a similar issue with, you know, lack of housing, house prices rising.
But Keith, we've a couple of advantages here, right? We're the last English-speaking country in the EU, so we're a beachhead for a lot of companies who want to have that. From a society perspective, we have proven in the last 15 years that we are an attractive, liberal society where people like to live. And also, we're blessed with some of the most beautiful scenery around, and we're deemed to be friendly people. That's the reason why so many people have moved to Ireland to work. And it's not just the low-level employees that are moving. We're seeing a significant influx. And the last numbers that I saw, I think it was in January, was that to continue to fuel the growth that existed. Now, this is all pre-COVID stuff, but to fuel the growth that was deemed necessary at the time, we were going to have to bring in 35,000 to 40,000 people from outside of Ireland every year to just keep the economy going at the growth rate. So we've proven that we're a very attractive place to live. I think now is the opportunity for some very bold governmental decisions over the course of the next 5 years.
John, I agree with you 100%. Absolutely. John, before we finish, in terms of next year, what do you think 2021 will look like for the work from home cohort?
Oh, that's a tough question. And the reason why that's such a tough question, you're asking me to guess what's going on in 2021. And this is my interpretation of what happened. We all went to bed on the 12th of March, 2020. And we woke up on the 13th of March, 2030. And that 10 years of growth in work from home happened overnight. And it literally did happen overnight. So I think we've skipped such an enormous period of time that to think about things in increments of 1 year is almost gone. So I tell you what I think is the biggest change, to be more serious and to answer your question directly. I don't think we'll ever see a company that will not have a significant contingency plan regarding remote work. One of the most disturbing statistics that I saw in the course of the last couple of weeks was that 70% of Irish businesses don't have an online presence. 70%. So essentially, that's 70% of businesses that were rendered essentially impotent, completely and utterly no power, no commercial power immediately. Lights went out and they had to pivot very quickly. And that's one of the reasons why, in some very, very strong initiatives from a variety of government organizations and government departments to drive as much enterprise as possible, because we must invert that. We must get 70 to 80 to 90% of Irish companies online so that they have that online presence. That to me is the single biggest change. So if there was one number to look at, it would be the number of Irish businesses that have an online presence.
Yeah, again, we're both on the same page. I suppose our experience in the last 6 weeks in Milkbottle, we're seeing obviously the demand from the consumer rising. So there's people buying online that never would have considered buying online in the past. You know, I mean, women by their nature like to go into shops and browse, try on clothes. We can see that there's a massive increase in fashion purchases online. But in addition to that, then there's the demand from the businesses to go online has also risen. So I would say that, you know, in our market and in the businesses that we're talking to, the move towards online from business point of view has been accelerated by, I'd say, at least 5 years. I would say even in other markets, it's probably even more. There's businesses now considering online that never, ever thought that they ever would have needed it.
Well, Keith, here's a way to think about it. As companies come to you and look for your expertise, all right, you're probably going to be recommending click and collect for companies that would not have even been able to spell click and collect a couple of years ago.
Absolutely.
It's going to be one of the most, it's going to be like having a telephone number, because there will be, for a period of time, probably until we have a really strong vaccination regime, where people will continue a level of physical distancing and will want to be able to purchase a product, but also to pick it up in the most distanced manner possible. So click and collect will potentially even for services, there's going to be, I mean, that's almost a perverse way to say it, but there will be a click and collect element to almost every purchase online. And we would never, ever have guessed that a year ago.
You're absolutely right. You know, the other rise in inquiries that we're seeing, for example, is services in terms of food. So not everybody, you know, the Just Eats and the Deliveroos, they don't cover, you know, entire countries. They only cover built up areas. Yep. So we're seeing an influx in queries in terms of services, primarily food. And there is, you know, the majority of chefs that run a restaurant or the majority of restaurant owners would never have thought that they would have ever needed an online presence, because people just walked in and picked up. So your point on the services is absolutely, absolutely very valid. We're living in changing times, but I do believe there's an opportunity. And also to your point earlier on, we're probably lucky that we're in the right area. So it's changed and it's not going to go back. John, I just want to finish, right? So is there anything else that you want to, do you want to plug Grow Remote, or is there anything else that you want to mention?
For me, Grow Remote is probably one of the most important things that I've been involved in the last couple of years, because it's the ultimate green jersey play for Ireland. And what started off as a green jersey play is actually a worldwide local jersey play. because every one of us is inextricably linked or tied to or has an emotional attachment to our locality, whether it's a suburb of a city or a small town or whatever. We have that level of connection. It's the most visceral thing that we have. And when there's an opportunity to have more employment in areas like that and more connection in areas like that, we all know it's a significant enhancer of the society and the culture. So, you know, from a legacy perspective, those of us who operate a lot in the remote space view the opportunity regarding this whole grow remote organization as being a significant opportunity to do something that in 20, 30, 40 years' time will bring the greatest level of change to our country and basically to the world. I think it is a big, big change. Now, it's not to say that we're not going to be in cities. Absolute rubbish. There's going to be a combination of both. But there's a slight rebalancing and a very small rebalancing of a couple of percent moving from cities to remote. That's all that's needed to start significant change happening.
Perfect. Okay. John, thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us today and sharing your experiences. Let's follow what's going on closely over the next few months. And I'd love to have you on again, maybe in 6 months' time, to just to look back on the changes and your experience.
Thank you very much, Keith. I'd actually love to do that. And I want to thank you for all you're doing, you and your team, for all you're doing in helping keep the e-commerce flag flying and flying very strongly, because we're going to have to grow out of this and we're going to have to share our experience with as many people as possible. So I would encourage you guys to continue leaning in and allowing people to lean into you to tap into your expertise also.
Perfect. John, thank you very, very much.
Thanks for listening to the Milk Bottle Shopify e-commerce podcast. All of our episodes are available on Spotify and iTunes. We really appreciate the support of our sponsor, Rewind.io, the leading backup solution for your Shopify store. Get your first month of Rewind for free. Just respond to any of the welcome messages or emails after you begin your 7-day free trial and mention our podcast. Until the next time, take care.